God gave this land to me, this brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat. I'm here with Kirk, and JB may have joined. I just don't see him on the switchboard at this point. But how are you this evening?
Good, thank you.
Good. I wanted to begin with talking about something that at one time, I think, made me extraordinarily sad. Probably the saddest that I've ever been, that I can recall. Now it doesn't make me sad so much as it causes me to feel like we're doing the right thing for the right reason. I had an occasion last night to watch a true story. It was about the story of how the French, even before Nazi occupation, began to round up Jews, and they forced Jews to wear the Jude star on their clothing. And they systematically stole their property, their apartments, their homes, and sent them into transit camps, separated men from women and then women from their children. And the harshness that they did this, the lies that they perpetrated, and just recognizing the horror of this and happening right in downtown Paris. And at the time, people shouting out the windows, you know, you deserve it, go away. Good riddance to the Jews, 76,000 of them, mostly women and children. One returned. The French did this on their own initiative. There weren't Nazi overseers rounding up the Jews. The French did. There were 76,000 of them, mostly women and children. And so the true story is about this one little girl who was taken off to one of the transit camps. She's separated from her mother and father. Her mother and father get sent to Auschwitz and are tortured to death. And this little girl, she has hid her little brother behind the wall in a locked closet. And she's hid him so that the Nazis don't take him to these concentration camps too. But she knows that inside that closet, when somebody goes there, he's going to die. There's no food, no water, not enough food, not enough water. And so it's this little girl's courage to risk her life to escape on behalf of her little brother. And, initially she finds a guard that's going to turn her in, and the way that she works with this guard to get him to help. And then just the way that she then works with a family that tried to shoo her away, but then she and her little runaway friend and the runaway friend died of, I think it's tuberculosis. And then we find her running into the room in Paris where she put her brother in the closet, and he was dead. And the story of her life thereafter. But all of the saints being shown, and just how the vast preponderance of people today have no real conception as to what happened. And it is part of human nature. We don't want to think of mankind as being torturous and despicable. You know, basically evil. We just don't want to think of ourselves that way. We don't want to think about the fact that it wasn't just the Nazis that did this, but the Poles and the Ukrainians and the Russians, the French and the British. Almost everyone capitulated. And the realization that while it would have been difficult to have stood up and make a difference, the fact that nobody stood up to make a difference is why it all happened. And really how horrible it all was, and why God is every bit justified in incinerating the world just as the world incinerated his people. And it makes me, in particular, feel a degree of satisfaction that we're doing the right thing. We're among the very few goyim devoted to caring about, to telling the story of, to lifting up, to encouraging the exodus of Jews. God's chosen people, defending them from all manner of conspiracy. And it was conspiracy that created the conditions that made the Holocaust possible. It was throughout this true story so incredibly obvious as to how the people had been brainwashed by conspiracy to think that the Jews deserved their fate. The very thing that we witness occurring now. That's why conspiracy is so amazingly dangerous. For the last two or three shows, Kirk, I have been mentioning the fact that Yana's testimony says something that I had missed previously, and I'm not sure that it's being discussed anywhere. But the more I read, the more my mind is open, the more I'm convinced that we're on to something here. And it is suggested here in the 103rd Mizmor, sixth statement, Yahweh does what is right, engaging honestly and fairly, showing good judgment and executing judgment on behalf of all who are unjustly exploited and contentiously mistreated. Those have been defrauded and oppressed, treacherously extorted and cheated. That little girl who grew up, she took her own life. Survivor's remorse, you know, she was the one out of 76,000 who were carted off by the French to go to Auschwitz to die in crematorium. And knowing what had happened to her brother and her mother and father was, and all the other little girls that she met along the way, was just too much to bear. If that woman doesn't get closure, then God's not just. If all of the people who have perpetrated the likes of protocols of the elders of Zion aren't held accountable and punished, God's not fair. If all of those who committed acts of pedophilia aren't held accountable in front of those that they abused, then there is no justice. The Romans that besieged and abused Yehuda not once but twice, all of those leaders need to be held accountable. The likes of Paul is 18 cohorts that spread the lie that became the most popular religion in the world, robbing billions upon billions of people of their souls. And every leader from imperial to Roman Catholicism to the Roman Catholic Church needs to be held accountable. And so on behalf of their victims, for a moment, these people are going to see, they're going to witness God's trial of these individuals, their humiliation, their disgrace, their condemnation, and their sentencing, knowing that they're going to endure forever in Sheol, all of them, for what they have done. And it's not just going to be the Adolf Hitlers, but all the Germans who went along, all the capitulators, all the French leaders, and the British, and the Ukrainians and the Poles and the Russians, all who went along to harm his people. And so this statement in Mizmor 103:6, it's exactly what it's saying. And that's really it's a profound insight. I mean, there are so many insights that we have been privileged to uncover, to find. And I'm translating Devarim Deuteronomy 29. And you know why, Kirk. It is one of the most sweeping prophecies in the entirety of the Torah. It covers 3,500 years of history. It runs from the first Exodus through the second. And in the midst of it, there is a mention of the role of Moshe would say, the long-awaited arrival of the Nakri, who we've talked about these prior weeks. And as I'm translating the 29th Mizmor, there were two things that were just, not Mizmor, but Devarim 29, the last book of the Torah. There were a couple of things that were just stunning. And we speak about insights here. You know, when every English Bible says, you are witnesses to all the signs and wonders, right? And so we assume that was God showing off all the miracles. Modern miracles. Because what? The religious people, they want their God to be fearsome and intimidating and able to zap you if you step out of line. Isn't that right?
That's the approach.
Well, the God I know isn't that way. He's not show-offy at all. Not fearsome. He's approachable, likable, lovable. Fun to be around. My dad. And come to find out that neither word that is used for sign and wonder means either of those things, aside from the idea that, well, Zion's a sign posted along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So they are signs that are filled with portent, signs that are and banners that are indicative of what's going to happen. They're like a road sign that says, if you go 5 miles that way, you're going to come to this place. If you take a left turn here, you'll end up at that place. That's what they were. Both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that the whole story of the Exodus is a harbinger of the next Exodus. Everything God said in it applies to us now, to calling his people out of, this time, Babylon. Come out of my people. Come out of her, my people. And today there are three Babylons. There's political, religious, and geographic Babylon. God's calling his people home. The Exodus is the story that is prophetic of that. That means that the story of the first celebration of Pesach, Matzah, and Mukkot is all indicative of their fulfillment. That's what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it should be viewed. It means that we should be viewing Pesach, Batzel, Bikurim as harbingers of things to come, of signs with portent, not just events to celebrate on the calendar.
Yeah.
And then he says, up to this point, and for a while longer, I've not given you minds to process this, eyes to see it, ears to hear it. And so maybe it really is God's intent, has been God's intent, is God's intent, that it not be readily available, that, well, it's there, it was readily accessible,
mm-hmm.
but people could read it and not see it. I mean, how many people do you think have read Dabarim 29 and thought, well, God was showing off with the big, you know, miracles, as opposed to him telling us that I'm showing the way home because prior to my return, which is going to occur in year 6,000, yeah, which isn't very far ahead because on your calendar, that's early October in 2033, you need to come home. How many people have done that?
Nobody.
Right. But that, so he said, I'm not giving you the capacity to do it. I didn't say I'm taking away your ability to see it. He didn't say I'm taking away your ability to listen. He didn't say I'm taking away your ability to think. He just says, I'm not giving you, bestowing upon you these things. And then he began to think and say, well, how and why is it then that we've been given the opportunity to see them?
If not now, when?
I guess so. If not now, when? If not us, who?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to do anybody any good unless somebody points it out to Yahweh's chosen people. And it isn't even going to do them any good unless we do it now, because there isn't much time left.
No,
you've been watching the news, but there's three U.S. congresswomen that as much as I'm frustrated by Trump and him, send them back was clearly the wrong phrase, and that two of them were actually born in America. But these three congresswomen are all Muslims. And two of the three wanted to go to Israel so they could meet with the mythical people known as the Palestinians and speak of boycotts on Israel. And boycotts in Israel become the academic cause celeb. In fact, it's difficult for Jews even to go to college today because of the prominence of these boycott movements. And Trump said, Israel, show some character, show some backbone, and preclude these three women from coming to Israel. And Israel did. And then relented with Tlaib, who's the nastiest and ugliest of them. Not the dumbest. The dumbest is that nitwit from Somalia. The one that wears the hijab. And they relented on Tlaib. She died to leave, and said that she could come so long as she doesn't make pronouncements of boycotting Israel, and Israel doesn't even have the right to exist while she's there. All that she said, well, but I'm not going because Israel is too oppressive. What the blank? Israel's oppressive. They're surrounded by 1.5 billion Muslims that want to wipe them out, that have done everything they can to destroy them, whose primary weapon today against them is terrorism. It's the only place where there is any modicum of freedom throughout that entire region, and the Israelis are oppressive? And she's a United States representative. And you know the ultimate nitwit, the little hijab wearer, Pelosi put her on the Foreign Relations Committee. She's a first-rate Jew-hater.
Therefore,
oh, put her on. What do you think Yahweh's view of America is when that happens?
Well, I know, I already know he can't stand us, and I just know the nail in the coffin.
And he's just said here, Yahweh does what is right, engaging honestly and fairly, showing good judgment and executing judgment on behalf of all who are unjustly exploited and contentiously mistreated. You know, there's a lot of people that have grievances that aren't just Holocaust related. I mean, you know, what happened in Japan when America decided that we were going to fight that war by being terrorists? And now look what the Japanese did in China and Korea and their abuse of women. Look what the Japanese did to the American soldiers in the Philippines.
Yeah.
It's a long history of man being disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And God said, I'm going to hold him accountable. Now, I shared last week, I said, you've got to be really careful not to interpret this statement incorrectly. Yahweh did not say that he was going to save everyone who has been defrauded, everyone who has been exploited, or everyone who has been oppressed. Only that he would show good judgment because he has to. This means that he will hold those who are mistreated and extorted, those who have been politically subjugated, religiously misled, militarily oppressed, economically enslaved, accountable. You know the longest running Lord slave, master slave period in place was by far the greatest number of people for the longest period of time. Who perpetrated the single greatest slave culture in the history of mankind? It isn't Rome.
That's
not Rome. Well, not Imperial Rome, I'm sorry. Not Imperial Rome.
Well, from the...
Imperial Rome, they were really good at it. The Greeks, of course, were great at it. The Carthaginians were spectacular at it. I don't think there's anyone better at it than the Spartans. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the Aztecs and the Incas and the New World, they were really good at enslaving people. Enslaving people is part of the history of humankind. People don't want to work, so they enslave people to do the work for them. But the most pervasive and the longest-running slave culture in human history, certainly not in the Americas with the colonies and what became the United States.
It has to be Europe, unless I got two options.
Yep.
You got China, or you got Europe, and Europe.
Yeah, Roman Catholic Church. Roman Catholic Church with Theodosius. Theodosius is the one that created the concept of the feudal system to control Europe. And the feudal system is a lord-slave system where the population has no rights. They don't own anything. The lords own everything and have all rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it lasted over an entire continent for over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So God's going to hold those people accountable. He has to be fair. It's just in his nature. And he's promised to do this. So he must do it. And so before those souls fade away, God's going to judge and sentence the perpetrators. Now, we know this, as did Dode, because we're Torah observant. It's the place through which we must all walk if our ambition is to know God. Dode, as one of the Ra'ah shepherds, Nabi, prophets, and Zeruah, which is the Lamb of God, said, he made known, yada, his ways, Derek, to Moshe, the one who draws out, through his interactions, Aliyah, with the children of Israel. It's Dode saying that. So what Dode is saying is, I have learned about God. I've come to know Yahweh because Yahweh made himself knowable through Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
People ask us all the time, well, what, do you believe in God? And we say, you're not religious. Well, do you believe in God? No. I'm not religious. Like I'm anti-religious. And no, I don't believe in God.
That's
I know
Yahweh.
Him. Yeah, I know him. Yeah, so it says I know him. What's the purpose of belief?
Yeah.
I know him. He knows me.
The other end of the phone.
Yeah. You know, we're on a first name basis.
Yeah.
Father, son. Teacher, student. Writer, reader. Speaker, listener. You know? Big guy, little guy. He made himself known and his ways to Moshe. So when Paul, the antithesis of Dode, the anti-Dode, wrote that the Torah can't save, that the Torah was antiquated, it makes him the anti-Moshe, anti-Dode.
Anti-Yahweh.
Yeah, anti-Yahweh. You know, he made known his ways through Moshe. But Paul said, but I, Paul, say. I'm sorry. The guy that Yahweh said, he's vindicated. He's the king past and future. He is my shepherd. He is the anointed Messiah. Dode says, Yahweh made his ways known through Moshe. Well, what's Yahweh's ways? Well, how about Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shabuah, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
How about the terms and conditions of the covenant and the benefits of the covenant?
Yeah.
How about the Torah as instructions and guidance as opposed to laws? How about 10 statements rather than 10 commandments? How about the real purpose of the flood? How about the real meaning of Babel, Babylon? How about the nature of the set apart spirit? How about about God's name, Yahweh?
Oh, well.
Yeah, so he made himself known through Moshe. You want to know God? Do what Dode did. Read the Torah. It's not hard. Through his instructions, through his actions and deeds, his practices and achievements, his effectiveness and engagements, his works with the children of Israel. Children of Israel are the focus group.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a problem with the children of Israel, good luck to you. Because you aren't going to have a relationship with God. I was talking with a good friend a couple of days ago, and maybe it was just yesterday after seeing this movie. And I just recall this sense that, well, I appreciate Yahweh's devotion to his people. And I understand Yahweh's frustration with mankind for abusing his people. It still doesn't make all of his people lovable. I'm still disgusted by religious Jews and their religious getup and their hashiming and their black clothing and their unwillingness to work and all of their laws and all of their corruption of what God actually said. And political Israel is tough, too, because Israel could never agree to a constitution, so they'd have this kind of power-sharing letter, giving half the power to the religious rabbis and the legislature have any other. Now, you can't get married or divorced without the rabbi. There's only one official religion in Israel, Rabbinic Judaism. So, it's very difficult to say that you have all-inclusive love for Israel. I realize that the rabbinical types, the overtly religious, they're never going to listen to anything Yahweh has to say. They're just too full of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're never going to have to spend any time with any of them. And heaven, there's no reason we should waste any time with them now. But fortunately, 80% of Jews are not religious.
Mm-hmm.
So Yahweh's collaboration with Moshe through the Torah could be summarized as three fathers and three Zeruah, shepherding rams among the sheep, in concert with one living God. The fathers are the harbingers and patriarchs of Yahweh's Berit covenant. They are Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, defining his conception, his purpose, and his people. The shepherds are the heralds of Yahweh's Torah guidance, Moshe, Dod, and Yosha, its inception, explanation, and embodiment. Collectively, they form the basis of Yahweh's menorah. You've got the six luminaries.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham, Yitzhak, Jacob, Moshe, Dod, Yosha, burning brightly on either side of the one true God. And if I really were to think about it, I would put Yosha in that number one slot because I view the menorah as reading, whether you choose to read from right to left or left to right, since Hebrew reads from right to left, let's go from right to left, and it's Pesach, Matzah, and Bekodim. Well, Pesach is Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes, that makes very good sense.
Yeah, matzah would be the whole concept of unyeasted bread would be Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
And the firstborn son,
Dod.
Bekodim,
yeah.
Dod. And it's Yahweh gleaming brightly in the middle, and then you have the three patriarchs of the covenant on the other side, Abraham,
Yitzhak,
and Jacob. And they are collectively, with Yahweh being in the middle, it would be Shavuah that's in the middle, being empowered and enriched and enlightened by God. With Teruah and Kippurim leading to the sixth candle, the candle on the far left side being Sukkah, camping out with God. It's also interesting, you can take the colors of the rainbow and take them right through the menorah as well. So it's not just that each menorah candle represents one of these seven individuals, and that each candle of menorah, this is all stuff you can learn by just paying attention, as Dod did to Moshe. Each candle of menorah represents one of the seven Moed Mikrei. But each candle of that menorah also represents one of the colors of the rainbow. What's the color of blood? And the sacrifice of the Passover lamb.
Red, of course.
Put red in the first spot. What's the second color of the rainbow, Mr. Artist?
I'm probably we're moving over to orange.
Orange. What's the closest color in the of the seven colors? Oh, there are seven colors in the rainbow. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Just by coincidence, it happened to be seven colors. And the rainbow, by the way, is the sign of the covenant. What's the closest of those seven colors to the color of bread?
Yellow.
Would it be orange? Orange?
Well, orange is, yeah.
So orange is matzah. So now we move from that to firstborn children. What's the brightest, the color that's the color of the sun, of light? And a being born as the firstborn son, being transformed into energy and light, what would be the color of that third candle? Bekodim.
Yellow.
Yeah, yellow, Dod, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And the center candle Now we're talking about Shavua, being raised and being growing with Yahweh, so that He empowers us and enriches us and enlightens us. What's the color of growth?
About green pastures and green.
Green, right? Green. The center color is green. You know, and then we go to heralding the message, telling the whole world about Yisrael and Yahweh. We move into blue. Mm-hmm. That is the color of everything Yahweh wants us to know about. It. It's Yahweh's favorite color, clearly, blue. And indigo mm-hmm. becomes the next color as we move out, and violet the last. The violet happens to be the color of royalty. Because when we're in Sukkah, camping out with our Heavenly Father, we are royal sons and daughters of God.
Well, that is true. The violet was always came from I think it was a shell or something in the Middle mm-hmm. East. It may have dyed, it may have been purple or the violet that
yep.
they used
mm-hmm.
much in the clothing to dye the clothes for the royal,
mm-hmm.
the royal purple, the royal red,
yes.
royal blue, whatever you want
yes.
to say to it, violet.
Yes. Yeah, and really what's interesting too is if you look at the rainbow colors, the blue and the indigo, the blue really is a light blue in the rainbow, and the indigo is really a rich, deep blue. And when you look at those colors, you get the deep, rich blue on Kippurim, on the reconciliation, where Yisrael and Yehudah are not only reconciled together, but also reconciled with Yahweh, renewed. And it becomes just this deep blue color, which is Yahweh's favorite color. It's his favorite moment. And the light blue is just being a foreshadowing of what is happening. It's just trumpeting the air through our shofars, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the seven colors of the rainbow. And you can layer on to those, as a friend of mine was talking at an epiphany the other day, because we're talking about bees. And you might say, why are you talking about bees now after colors and menorah, just after reading this one simple statement, he made known his ways to Moshe through his instructions with the children of Israel. Why go into all this other stuff? Because that's how he made his ways known. All of this is laid there for our eyes to see, for our minds to contemplate, for our ears to hear. And the more we understand that God conveyed through Moshe, the better. What was Israel called? The land of what?
Milk and honey.
All right. Where does honey come from?
The bees, the beehive.
Are you familiar with the Hebrew word for bee?
I've heard it, but I can't recall.
It's the feminine of the word for word.
Oh, right. Dubbery. I mean,
it is the feminine of the word for word. honey is the word.
Oh,
that's what makes it so sweet. Because honey has a number of properties. One is it's very sweet, but honey is its own natural preservative. If you put honey in a masonry jar 3,000 years ago, unrefrigerated, you can still eat it.
Yes, they found them.
So the word of Yahweh is everlasting, and it's very sweet for those who love him. So honey, and it's the bada. And so, did you know that the one thing that makes bees particularly unique is their eyesight? Bees can see better than any other animal. I didn't know that. So, if you really want to appreciate the sweetness and enduring nature of the word, the bada, you want to have really keen insight. That's the sight of the bees. And what the bees are able to do is they're able to see, happen to be seven categories of light. Now, from the shortest wavelength to the longest wavelength, and all we can see is visible light. Well, the bees actually see beyond that. Yeah, infrared, actually. Mm-hmm. And so what this person shared with me, and I think they're right, is that just as we are empowered when we go from physical to an energy-based being, which gives us greater access, that means that we can actually maneuver in a sixth-dimensional universe and enter the seventh dimension, things that are beyond our comprehension at this point. But we're going to see things that we never even imagined that we could see. We're going to see across all seven of the wavelengths of light, not just this tiny strip of visible light. But we're going to see all of those wavelengths and how much more clearly and broadly we're going to be able to see.
That's amazing.
So there's those seven spectrum of light, way beyond just the infrared, are all candles on that menorah as well. So there's just so much to consider. I even think there's an ode to the five conditions and five benefits of the covenant in the menorah, because it was comprised of five integrated components. There's a base, shafts, cuffs, leaves, and petals. Its life was produced by the olive, the tree which represents Yahweh's spirit, the eternal light God will use to enlighten and reconcile his relationship with Israel and Yehuda, the longest living tree in that part of the world, the purest form of light. It is the means to being anointed. It is the means to healing. It is nourishing. There's an interesting side. Not only was the olive oil the purest form of light in the ancient world, do you know that olives are one of the few, if only, trees that are pollinated by the wind?
Yeah, that's a good idea. The Ruach Kodesh?
Yeah, the Ruach. Yeah, Ruach and wind is the same word.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would say this always with an appreciation for Yahweh having a sense of humor, but he obviously cheats. I mean, his metaphors are perfect. And so, yeah, I suspect he designed his metaphors. Yes, just much as they would be perfect like this. Of course, the olive is perfectly representative of that. It's kind of like the, who would have thought that the three symbols that Yahweh has for saved souls, wine, which are crushed grapes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bread, which is crushed flour, correct?
Flour, right.
And olive oil, which is crushed olives.
Mm-hmm.
That all three have to go through a pressing form before they're usable.
Black bread under the ground. Yes.
Yeah. And that kind of evocative of the fact that when we all go through challenges, every single one of us. I don't think there's any covenant member that I have ever met that didn't have issues, either family issues or health issues or some kind of issue. We all go through challenges. It's those challenges that build character. Do you think Dode would have been the insightful psalmist he was?
No.
Had it not been for the fact that so much of his life was challenging, so much of his family was in upheaval, if everything was just perfect, what would he write about? Boy, life is really wonderful.
Yeah, no.
Too bad for you that your life isn't as wonderful as mine.
I don't know that song.
I don't know that song. Life is challenging. And it's the challenges that build backbone and characters, what makes us interesting. Because, you know, we've talked about this before, there's the reason that our souls are what's going to accompany us into the next life. Because our souls are the reservoir for what makes us unique. They convey our personality, our proclivities, our attitudes, our aptitudes. We get to take all those with us. You know, if somebody is a bit of a curmudgeon in this life, they're going to be a bit of a curmudgeon next. If you're a bit of a rascal, we're going to have rascals. You know, what fun would life be without the occasional lovable rogue? But everybody can't be a lovable rogue, right?
No, we have to
make things boring. So,
when you, may I interrupt just a second? When you run across stuff, and I read the paper on the one you were talking about, it was rather fascinating. I just had a chance to respond, but when you run across that many things, and just going back just for a moment, the menorah with the three fathers and the three zeruah and things.
Right.
I mean, I look at it and I just go, wow, this is just the most amazing connection of dots, I guess, as a trite way to say it, perhaps. But it's just, I'm just over, you look at it and you just go, this is amazing. Who could do this?
Well, you know, what I think that the answer is in that Dabarim statement that I was talking about. I think that is the answer, if I may be so bold. I genuinely think it's right there.
Yeah.
And yet, what, you know, yeah, I'll just read it. I want to start at the beginning, because the beginning here is so amazing. This is really a seldom considered prophecy. It was revealed by Moshe, chronicled in the Torah teaching regarding the Bereth covenant in Israel. And it's set within the context of being led out of Mitzrayim, the crucibles of oppression. It's going to, at the very end, we're not going to go that far tonight, references the Nakri, the observant foreigner. The prophecy plays out over the span of 3,500 years, culminating with Yahweh's return. This is how it begins. These, providing perspective on God, up close and personal, are the words, the Dabari, of the covenant, Habareth, the family-oriented relationship agreement, which correctly lead to the benefits of the relationship, Asher, which give meaning to life, which Yahweh instructed, Shawa taught and directed, educated and authorized, for Moshe to cut and establish Karat with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, along with and as part of the covenant he cut in association with them in Chorab. Isn't it interesting that they would be in Moab? Because it's out of Moab that they're being called at this time. It's questioning who in the world is your father. But, so, did you know that there was an entire chapter of Dabarim devoted to the correct presentation of the words of the covenant? Then Moshe, you know, after Yahweh presents the covenant, dominating the book of Bereshith, and how he develops the covenant relationship with Abraham, now Moshe is saying, these are the words of the covenant. He is summarizing everything he has learned in the Torah and said, these are the words of the covenant. That's the reason that Yahweh instructed me and authorized me, is to share and establish with you, the children of Israel, in this land of Moab, this covenant, which is part of the covenant that we established in Chorab. And Moshe summoned, calling out to Kara, all of Israel, those individuals who engage and endure with God, saying to them, now this was just hit me like a ton of bricks. I did not know this was here, and it's not just in this statement, it's really in the following one. It says to them, you yourselves have witnessed at Emrah, you have been shown and seen everything that Yahweh, and then it's a Shah, acted upon and engaged in. Well, the Shah is the key word for the covenant. You need to act upon and engage in it. The Shah acted upon and engaged in before your eyes in the realms of the crucibles of oppression before Pharaoh, before all of his servants, and throughout his land. Now, next, God makes this a statement that I think has been completely missed. And I think it's been missed for 3,500 years. God was not bragging. He wasn't trying to impress the Israelites or scare the Egyptians. He was instead conveying a message to us pertaining to this very day. But the religious types have been eager to show their God is fearsome and impressive, able to perform great signs and wonders. And so theologians have trivialized something that was designed to be profound and prophetic. The two words in question here are oath. Gee, I don't know if there's an English word that is transliterated similar to oath. Are you familiar with one?
Yeah, take an oath.
You had to make a promise, right?
Make a promise.
Yeah. Oath. That should have been a clue. And then Mopath. They're only signs, and they're only wonderful in the sense that these wonderful signs point us in the right direction because they reveal what's going to occur along the way. So rather than you say, wasn't that great? Did you see all that stuff I did? It's instead that the entire experience in Egypt and during the Exodus was designed to foreshadow the fulfillment of Passover, unleavened bread, and firstborn children in 33 CE, and the second Exodus just prior to 2033. With Yah calling his people out of Babylon, it means that we should study the events which transpired around Moshe with an eye to the future, thereby understanding what God is offering and seeking in return. This is how it reads. The tremendous adventure of examination and proving, and of getting the desired response, Hamasha, the time of trials and testing, the period of evaluation, which for the benefit of the relationship you saw, witnessing with your eyes, the appearance of the conspicuous and distinguishing signs and prophetic proof statements, ha-oth, the promises which will be remembered because they are predictive foreshadows, along with the miraculous means of communicating the message with distinctive banners and characteristic signals regarding future provision, and the extraordinary and remarkable indications of the amazing things which will come. Ha, Moshe, Ha, Gadol, I am. The marvelous symbols laden with tremendous portent, along with the great expectations of things which will occur, the wondrous tokens of future events. Now it's gone from being show off to showing the way. Which one do you think that God was interested in doing?
He's showing the way. You get to get home.
Absolutely.
Looking to build a family. What else can he... That's the whole motive.
So sometimes I wonder why so few have seen and shared the insights. Like that
you
know, come to appreciate.
This week I was asking that question because you asked the question. You said maybe I've said too much about the terms and conditions. You went from Dode, White, and Dode. All the things about the Nisswa and so forth. And I thought for a few minutes, and you know, you've covered in great detail why. You can say all this now, and it still won't let in the door somebody who's not into this or wants to be. We got, and I started thinking about. So I looked up Nahor and Haran, which, of course, Abraham's two brothers.
Yeah.
And Haran, of course, is the mountain hill country, but it's also the mountains of illicit worship. And so I categorize that obviously as religious. you cannot talk to a religious person and they will hear anything. They're not going to hear. They would rather save their religion and spit on God, spit on Yahweh. There's no thrill for them to be with Yahweh. They want to be with their religion, and that's sad beyond belief. But they're not, the words won't lead them anywhere. Only the preachers or the popes or whatever. And then you have Nahor. That's the one with the snorting nostrils because he's snoring, he's asleep. But the rest of them that you talk to don't care. I mean, I have a really good friend that gave me a job when I first came to California, helped me throughout my career, kind of a mentor to a degree. And he, I shared all this with him, and he believed I was right. He didn't care. He said, well, I'll send you the book, and you can read it yourself. And said, no, don't do it, Kurt, because I won't read it. I mean, and he's such a nice guy. He won't care. So that's the vast amount of the world. So you could say all this verbatim, even give them the short script, and it would still wouldn't resonate. They won't care.
Mm-hmm. I handed a fellow really short story. Now it's a book all by itself. You can buy it at Amazon. Written in Stone is the name of it. If you Google my name at Amazon or Yada Ya at Amazon, it'll take you to the book. It's Written in Stone is the title of the book. And I think it's only like 70 or 80 pages the way that it's set. And, you know, the normal length that I write in is probably closer to 90 pages. But it's pretty short for a book. And it's strictly on the 10 statements. And this person got to about page 20 and said, man, is there any way that you could introduce these thoughts in a little simpler manner? This is really complicated. He says, it's profound. I'll tell you all the things I found in here that just really resonated with me, because I went into a whole philosophical analysis in it of, and if you haven't read the rewrite of the terms, the Mitzvah volume of An Introduction to God, it's three times the length, and it's hugely better than the original version. And there's this whole discussion between legality and morality. Demonstrating why the 10 statements could not be commandments. And why, if you just understand the difference between morality and legality, and we'll go over that one day, you realize that you cannot legislate a relationship. So he was talking about all the things that are really profound, but said, could you please just make it a little bit easier? How many people are going to be smart enough to follow this?
No, you come to the end of the 70th page and you cry because it stops at 70. That's the response. More. Give me more.
Yeah. And I said, it's not dumbed down. Listen, I said, look, first of all, I'm no scholar. And so it's not written at the level of someone with a PhD. These are ordinary words. You can look them up. If you need a dictionary, look them up. But these are ordinary words. Sure, it's a love affair with the words. Sure, I have a love affair with the word of Yah. That's true. I make no excuse for that. And I really go into depth of what the words mean, because I love the words. Yahweh is knowable and understandable, approachable because of his words. And so, yeah, I celebrate his words. Every nuance that comes in, you do too. Sometimes you even go further than I do. We love his words.
And I like his words.
Yahweh doesn't dumb it down. The only attempt he ever makes for a summation is the 10 statements. So I said, all right, if I'm going to have one short book, have it be on the 10 statements, because that's the only place that he really attempts to say, all right, I'll give you a summarized version. Here's the Clip Notes version. But even it, you know, it turned out to be quite long, but it's and so I made him this promise. I said, tell you what, yeah, it's the single most prevalent request that I get is to come up with a simpler version, a simpler, shorter version, just an introduction to all of this. Which was the original purpose, by the way, of this book was to be an introduction, you know, something that was digestible. I mean, you pick it up, it's a thin little book. You know, I've got nothing else but these big tomes. This is a thin little book. And it's supposed to be an introduction. You know, if it even says introduction, if you're comfortable with this, if you like this, if this is intriguing to you, then jump in and read from the beginning. Yeah, dig in. And that's the promise I made. I said, do it. You get through this book, and you get through either yada yada or observations for our time. And if you, at the end of that, still have the same perspective that this should be made easier, more approachable, then I'll tell you what, we'll write the approachable introduction together. I'll work with you. You come up with somebody in mind that you think this is too cerebral for, and we'll write it with somebody with that person in mind, and we'll introduce them to it. But I want you to know a number of things. God is really smart. He is a brilliant communicator, and as much as you might think that I'm overly zealous about the insight that can be derived from his word, let me tell you, the best I'm probably doing is a fraction of 1%. And so I'm not doing all that hot a job. Second, is the primary audience for this book are the brightest people in the history of humanity. Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it should be embarrassing to Jews that a goyim is explaining their writings to them. But it's only because there wasn't anyone of them willing to stand up and do it. But and maybe a little, and I think that for Jews, it's time to eat a little humble pie. But they're bright. If their mind is open and they're willing to eat some humble pie and to say, we've been wrong, it's time we stop blaming God and start acknowledging him and accepting him. They're smart. They're well-educated. I don't think they'll have any trouble reading these books.
Hmm.
And we found that a disproportionate number of those who have engaged in the covenant either knew they were Yahudim, Jewish, and were secular Jews and found this and it just resonated with them. They're like so many others, they have now done a DNA test, and guess what? I would say it's the majority of those who are now in the covenant have found that, guess what? They're Jewish. Yeah, I was among the few. Guess what? I'm not. I'm a Goyim. And so it's written for them. And I said, I want to tell you something else. That for years and years and years, I was mad at a lot of things when I was starting to translate yada yada. I was mad as hell at the religious leaders and the religious publishers and everyone who had misled me because they knew better. I was angry at them, still angry at them.
Yeah.
But I was also a bit angry at God. I'm not anymore, but I was. And I say, God, why didn't you make it easier? What? I mean, can you just please say that Passover is the doorway to life and then matzah is the threshold upon which we are perfected and we rid ourselves of religious and political corruption, leading to firstborn children, which is about becoming part of your family. So that we're enriched and empowered on Shabbat. Why not just lay it out that way? Why don't you say, okay, I've told you this whole story of the covenant through Abraham, and if you were following along, you probably noticed that there were five conditions. There were five things I asked of Abraham, all of which he agreed to. and I offered him five benefits. And you might look and say, you know, there's five hands in my name, and there's five fingers on your hand. That's maybe a way to remind you that these are the five terms and conditions of the covenant, the five benefits. Why not say that?
Maybe
you
wouldn't judge
so hard, though. Yeah, that's why I said one of the things that God doesn't want to make entry to heaven easy. Because if he did, he'd have far too many people there that would make life miserable for the rest of us that just got in because they parroted. So, okay, I agree to this, that, and the other. You know, when we were separating from that horrible social media site that was and still remains so ingrained in conspiracy theory, they all could parrot the transliterations and my books and call themselves Covenant to use Yahweh's name. Well, we have to have a, God has to have a filter that keeps those people out.
You know the two names that I just shared with you, the Charon or Haran, and Nahor?
Mm-hmm.
Do you realize that they have a chet between them and Yahweh in the increase?
Yeah.
They have a
offensive. Yeah, divider. They can't be crossed between.
Is that something?
Yeah. Brilliant insight.
Yeah.
I mean, I still think your most brilliant insight on examining what Yahweh revealed regarding his way through Moshe is your realization that that half the letters in Hebrew lean. They're directional. And when they're directional, it's facing a letter in Yahweh's name, they're positive. When they're facing away from a letter in Yahweh's name, they're negative.
Yeah.
Just like this chet in those three names. You've got the hand of Yah on one side, or a letter that represents Yah on one side, and on the other side, you've got the increase and fence between the two of them.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn. Now, this is that statement that I wanted to conclude before we went back to where we were. But Yahweh had not bestowed, giving you the judgment or inclination to know and understand. This is Leb. The judgment, inclination, the disposition, the thought process, the mind or will to know or understand. Yada. To notice, perceive, be aware of, acknowledge, to observe. And really, to see these insights, the eyes and perspective to see, the ears to hear, up to this time and beyond this day. It's kind of like, I guess, to some degree, why Yah had to intervene at the flood, why Yah had to intervene with Babel.
Mm-hmm.
Is that man got too far ahead of himself, the whole timeline that Yah had established could be altered, and it might end up with a world that just chokes out his people. Yeah, it chokes out everything. And so religious and political men, which is really all that was empowered for, you know, it's a unique situation that we're in, Kirk, where we're able to study and share Yahweh's words without a position of religious or political power or influence. In fact,
and no agenda.
The opposite.
Yahweh's agenda.
Right. So what if somebody that was religious or political came to understand some of these things and manipulated them for their self-interest?
Well, then they were going to be punished tremendously.
Right. And in our case, we have no religious influence. We have no political influence.
No.
We don't have a following. No money, no nothing.
No,
and so we can do it today because there's no manipulation. It's just saying, here it is. If you want to capitalize on it, wonderful. If you don't, that's your choice.
Yeah, free will. We all have free will.
Yeah. So God said, he didn't take away, he didn't blind us. He didn't say that. He didn't say that he made us deaf. He didn't say that he crippled our ability to think. He just says, I have not given you the judgment or inclination to know or understand. The eyes to see, the ears to hear. Not at this time. So you want to know why we depict the menorah as we do? Why we see the first Exodus as a harbinger for the second Exodus? One from Mitzrayim, the other from Babel? Why? Because Yahweh has given us the inclination and the good judgment to know and understand and the perspective to see. It's been there the whole time.
Well, that's paramount. But you, as you always say, we're in an era when we can look at words like no one ever could. Even though
right.
we're doing it through English and back and forth from Hebrew back to English and our native
right.
tongue, we're still...
Yeah, and I think there's something else to it as well, which is that, Kirk, everyone that Yahweh picked to do something important had... baggage, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, Abraham not only came out of Babylon, he was married to his half-sister, and he was dragging along Lot, who turned out to be a scallywag, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you know, Lot, Abraham's sitting there meeting with God personally, and rather than saying, all right, God, you know, I'll do this, but, you know, can... Since what you're asking of me is so unusual, can we maybe have a little negotiation here? No, he just says, no, I don't get it, God. I don't get it. You know, what's this thing about an inheritance? I don't have a son. What good is an inheritance? Well, come on, dummy. You're the one that's inheriting. I'm the father. You're the son.
Yeah.
You're inheriting eternal life. You're inheriting perfection. You're inheriting being adopted into my family.
You're inheriting the Father.
You're inheriting the universe.
Well, and everything you've got.
Come on. And also, I have a friend of mine that gets mad at me every time I say that Abraham wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. But the fact is, that was his baggage. Well, Moshe. But God, I mean, this was a murderer who fled Egypt in shame and was a murderer. God says, you're the guy that I'm going to speak through. You're going to become the greatest prophet in human history. You're the ultimate liberator. I'm going to go up against this, you and this 80-year-old broken-down man who stutters. And we're going to go against the most powerful kingdom in the world, Egypt. All right.
That's pretty cool.
You know, he's going to talk about creating a family relationship and the importance of this devotion to family with a philanderer, with a guy who didn't even know how to handle his own family.
Yeah.
But you know, Kirk, even though each of those individuals had issues. Look at Jacob.
Oh, yeah.
And Jacob hated the wife he should have loved and loved the wife that he should have hated. You know, Rachel, coveting idols.
Yeah.
And Leah being the mother of Yehuda. You know, so... They're all a little bit broken.
Yeah.
But they all had something that made them desirable for Yahweh to use. And so as we turn the clock forward and we look at where we are today, do you think God's changed?
No, he never changed.
Do you think he's trying to pick the somebody that's really honorable and perfect and just the, if you're going to represent me, you're going to be tall and handsome and strong, and you're going to have the perfect voice to convey this message. You're going to be the most brilliant writer. You're just going to wow the world. You're going to be Charlton Heston meets Ernest Hemingway.
Do you think maybe not?
Has that been his trend? Has he ever said, you know, you're right, Israel needs a king, so let's pick the biggest, baddest, tallest, strongest guy to be king? No, that's Shepherd. Down there, 10 sheep in Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be my guy.
And then put him on a donkey and send him home. Send him
right.
To Jerusalem.
How many of Yahweh's prophets were religious leaders?
None that I recall.
How many of his kings were political leaders prior to being chosen? Did anybody that Yahweh chose have any credentials through which anybody would be impressed?
Not really.
No, not one. Not one.
No.
So, fast forward to today. If he doesn't reveal, he doesn't provide people today with the judgment and inclination to yada know and understand, and the eyes and perspective to see, and the ears to hear, if he doesn't know, then it was all for naught. We've gone 3,450 years in this condition. We go another 15. It's all for naught. All of those insights, all of those signs posted along the way, all of those harbingers of what's to come, all of the insights that are essential to knowing who God is and what he's offering, are all for naught if they are not revealed now, in writing and verbally. If we're not doing what we're doing, it was an utter waste of time. That doesn't make us important.
Not a waste of time.
No.
He's going to call out his
right.
People.
And so, you know, you might have been a scratch golfer, had a pretty mean swing, maybe a heck of an artist. But my guess is that you're probably, if you were to walk into downtown San Francisco and stand up on a soapbox, no one is going to mistake you for being the George Clooney and Brad Pitt combined with the oratory of Ronald Reagan.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure you're right.
Pretty sure that's not going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not going to happen with me either. And yet, here we are. Why? Because God has changed. He has his reasons for choosing the people that he wants to reveal himself through. And, you know, understand, too, we're doing a very different job than was done 3,500 years ago, that was done 1,000 years ago, that was even done 2,500 years ago. We're doing a very different job.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because the job they were doing is they were inspired by Yahweh to write prophetic statements that would be available to the world. We're not doing that. God's not doing that with us. What he is giving us is the ability to understand what he conveyed through them.
Through them.
Right. He's making what he said relevant and knowable to his people at this time. And so, to do that, you would think you would get the foremost Hebrew scholars in the world the foremost archaeologists who were totally fascinated by the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
So an archaeologist, a Hebrew scholar,
yeah.
an ancient language expert,
mm-hmm.
a theologian that, you know, would understand the ways of God, right?
Yeah, you know,
with academic and religious credibility, but no. Broken down golfer and a has-been businessman. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, my guess is you're probably not a scratch golfer, and I'm
no
one's going to mistake me for the you know, next Elon Musk.
Yeah. No, we're has-been is good, I think, or not hardly there.
Yeah, so
no.
That's why we find ourselves doing this.
Yeah.
And that's why we're surrounded now by people who do it as well. Well, there's so many out there that are now translating and writing and sharing and thinking and coming up with brilliant insights. If not now, when? If not us, who?
Yeah.
And if not us, and now, then all of this, these
waste.
Signs that he posted along the way, these symbols for us to analyze that speak to us at this time, it was all for naught. What good is a Torah if the guardians of that Torah are going to turn to their Talmud?
That's so awful.
What good are the prophets if those who should be honoring them and communicating about them have pasted on a New Testament that is completely contradictory to it? What good is it if you've got 2.5 billion Christians and 1.5 billion Muslims all saying, well, that stuff's inspired, but we changed it all? What good is it?
Well, what good is it to have the Yashayahu scroll right in the middle of Jerusalem in a building where anyone can access and look at it and nobody reads it? And we're over here.
Correct.
Studying it. Every
right.
word.
Right.
Every letter.
You know, why is it that after all of this time we ended up focusing on two things? Well, three things. Torah, Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
The Mizmor, Dud, and the Navi, Yeshaya. Almost everything we write falls into one of those three categories. Now, I don't know if it's almost 20,000 pages. Why? Because they are the Zeruah. They are the Navi. They are the Ra'ah shepherds. So, this is the next statement, and boy, we have been all over the place except on Mizmor 103, but be that as it may, there's a passion behind the words that we speak, and we want them to resonate with the audience that God wants to call home. And it says, Yahweh is compassionate and merciful, long-suffering and loyal, slow to anger, and abounding in goodness, overwhelmingly kind and steadfastly loyal, all while showing great favoritism and passionate love. Thank goodness. If he wasn't, we'd be in a whole world. Can you imagine if he wasn't, what the chance would be that he's going to reconcile his relationship with five Jews, much less 5,000, much less 50,000. But what do you think the chances would be if he was not compassionate and merciful, long-suffering and slow to anger?
No, there would be none if he were not.
No. But I can tell you that I was a scallywag. I was religious and political. What do you think my chances would have been if God were not overwhelmingly kind.
Well, I tried to finance the devil too, you know, by giving so much money to the church, and yeah, absolutely. We would have no chance.
None. So, it is through the Torah, on behalf of his people, that Yahweh is Rakham. It's the word that fleshed out Abram. You know, Abram became Abraham based on Rakham, compassionate, merciful, enduring commitment to abiding adoration for those he's offering a reprieve from judgment. It's a derivative of Rakham with the suffix, which denotes all things associated with this concept. And merciful, wa chanun, inclined to bestow favorable treatment and provide unearned benefits along with generous blessings. And it's a derivative of chanam, again with the suffix.
Mm-hmm.
Long-suffering and loyal, slow to anger, erect, off, able to endure that which is resentful and displeasing in the relationship for a long time. And then what Rob just said, abounding in goodness, steadfastly loyal, all while showing great favoritism and passion and love. This is the God that we know. And to be honest, he'd have to be this way to put up with and indeed love the likes of you and me. But it's also true with Moshe and Dawud. And that's why this statement, including Rakum, Chanum, and Chesed, along with the unique modification of Amph, is so profoundly important. Moshe and Dawud were highly flawed individuals, and both had their moments where they were dunderheads, as is the case with every one of us. We're not perfect, not even close. And yet, as long as we strive to know and respect our Creator to the point that we invest the time to comprehend what He is asking of us and offering in return, then He is magnanimous. No matter how fast and furious we dig, His shuffle is bigger and better. He always gives us far more than we can offer Him. And yet, it's His nature to celebrate what we do together. So I said, He moves heaven on earth for those He loves and who love Him in return. I mean, think just for a moment, Kirk. I wrote Prophet of Doom, which excoriates Muhammad and Islam. Just absolutely destroys the religion. All credibility of Islam. Lays it out naked and bare as a criminal enterprise and terrorist manifesto led by a rapist and pedophile and mass murdering terrorist. And I wrote it under my own name. Still out there on the internet. Under my own name. And I did 5,000 national and international radio shows under my name.
Yeah.
And yet I've never ducked. I've never been threatened by a Muslim. Oh, I've received 10,000 death threats online. Do you know how many of those Muslims were allowed to follow through and show up in my door or threaten me in person? Zero. If we're doing what God wants us to do, He will move heaven and earth to take care of His children. Even when His children are flawed and dented and everything else, He still loves us. He protects us. He does what a good father should do.
Yeah. I reminded somebody of that today. And so that, you know, heaven and earth will, you know, He'll just protect you. Don't worry.
Yeah. Now, he's not saying that I'm going to give you a long and pain-free life. You know, we're mortals. We have a life we can contribute to it, but when we make our lives count, when our lives are really focused on doing something Yahweh wants to do, yeah, He's going to prolong them.
He's going to be right there with you.
It's in His interest. It's in His children's interest. He's a loving Father. He does what's in His children's interest.
Yeah. and he always delivers when you're doing what's in his interest.
Correct. I think we have more to do. I think I was going to continue to keep this around while we do it.
This is great fun. I hope so.
And when you know, we're done, because, you know, Dode reached a point where he was done.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, you read the sixth Mizmor. Dode was toast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think he was toast for a lot of reasons. And I've been really close a number of times, and, you know, my burden job isn't even in the same hemisphere of his, but there have been times, you know, you get some of these hate letters, and people get really personal with their attacks, and they're just disgraceful and disgusting, and you know, they're using my translations and transliterations to attack me personally. And, you know, it's, you could say, okay, why am I doing this? You know, it's not like I'm making a nickel out of it. I'm paying for to receive this abuse. Thank you very much. And, you know, so there's times when I said, oh, boy, why am I doing this? Particularly to show that I can write all day long and just not answer the email, and we're, you know, I'm happy as a lark. But, you know, Dode was different. You know, I've had people say, you know, it's true that I don't suffer fools well, but I don't go after them. You know, unless somebody comes to me or in front of me makes some kind of a really stupid statement about God, I'm just, you know, I'm not walking into a church and exposing and condemning them. I'm not going out of my way to, there's a Chabad Rabbinical Center just down the street. I'm not walking in there and saying, you know, wake up. What you're doing here is stupid. I'm not going to Roman Catholic forums and saying, stop it, morons. You're disgusting. Dode did. And Dode was just no nonsense. Anybody was going to say anything that was negative about Yahweh, he was in their face. He fought every battle. And I just don't think you can do that. I have a really good friend that wants to fight every foe. And I said, just let it go. They want to correct every mistake somebody says around them when it comes to God. And I said, no, just let it go. There are battles you cannot win. And they're just going to take energy away from you that you can use somewhere else. Pick your battles. But Dode didn't. And towards the end, he just had too much. And he wore down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he stopped writing inspired psalms. So it can happen to any of us. And, you know, I think that for that reason, one of the things I've really tried to do, and I would recommend this of everybody, is that you pace yourself. You know, we're not called to wear ourselves out. Tonight is Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow is, you know, enjoy yourself. Recharge. So, you can't work 7 days a week and push.
I want you to listen to this.
Right. Exactly.
You're the hardest worker among us.
Well, you know, but part of that
excitement,
Kirk, is I didn't know it when I was doing this. I had a sense that what we were doing was really important, and that it needed to be done, and that there were thousands upon thousands of souls that were going to benefit from this. And I was so thrilled to be learning what we were learning, and so excited by the pursuit of knowledge, and so invigorated by each day's new insights. That, you know, I did it. And part of it, until about a year ago, it was my peaceful place. I was in a horrible marriage with a person who just has become monstrous recently. And it was my place. My place to live and to give meaning to life. And so, you know, that was part of the motivation, and my happy place. And it still is. You know that I turned to Devarim 29 because of it's prophetic, and it speaks of this concept I didn't even know anything about a month ago called Anagri. Mm-hmm. But now that I know it, there's a responsibility. I didn't seek it. I'd gladly give it off to anybody else that wants it. There's a lot that goes with it. But I don't think I can or should ease up. I just don't think so. I think that there's, those who were closest to Moshe went to him. And there's a whole conversation that's recorded and said, you know, you're burning the candle at both ends. You know, you're trying to help the people individually, and yet you're trying to educate the people collectively. You've been doing this a long time, and you just can't keep on doing this. There's not enough of you to go around. And I don't feel that way. I don't think Moshe did either. And Moshe didn't. What Moshe did is say, you're right, there's a number of us now that are equipped to do so much, and let's have everybody join in and work together. And he did do that. But there is no indication that he himself went into Shabbat mode.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of where we find ourselves, is that there are some just marvelous covenant members that are bright, and they're contributing in wonderful ways.
I know a bunch of them. They're very good.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet we have very little time left. And the more we can translate, the more insights we can share, the richer the experience is going to be in forever. And the next 10 years or so, Kirk, is such a small amount of time, and one man's life is such a small thing to contribute, when we're thinking about how many more may, as a result, enjoy an eternity with us.
Oh.
It's worth it.
Yep.
And it's not a sacrifice. It's the happiest part of every day.
Yeah. It is pretty thrilling just to look at it.
I mean, yeah.
I go to places that have no reason to go other than that triggers something, and I'll go over there and do that. I know JB does that too, because we talked about it.
Yes.
But it's, that I'll be on this stream of a certain thing where we're going to a certain area, and then I'll have a little side step, and the next thing I know, I've spent an hour doing stuff. But it certainly was beneficial for me. I mean, sometimes.
Yeah.
You know,
and I get emails every day from several very insightful, but one in particular who is a little less research. Mm-hmm. And no matter what I write or say, she said, but you need to go translate this. And you do and say, oh, my. And that leads to, oh, my. And that leads to, oh, my goodness. If I had only known. And then what I find is that had I gone to any of these places a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I'd have missed it all. It's just the right time.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to grow before you're able to see so many of these things. You know, they're there now for us to see because, well, we've invested the time to learn.
Well,
we have the right perspective because, well, we've
laid the groundwork.
Been at this for a very long time.
Yeah.
No, I think it's 18 years going on 19. It's a long time.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, tonight with the menorah alone, was tremendous.
Oh, I love the menorah thing. Yeah, it was a friend started me on that direction, and then we've been adding to it with the the bees and the bada and with light and with the spectrum, and then who are the individuals that are in each of the candles, and how do they tie into the Moed Mikre, and yeah. And then there's another layer to it that we didn't share tonight, but I took the most important words to Yahweh that he shares with us, and I attributed these most important words to each of those candles as well. I thought it was kind of fun to do, but, you know, it's, and it's, everybody can have their own. You could, you know, each of us could come up with a slightly different variation of it, and it could be every bit as insightful and helpful.
Well. It's a pretty good place to start.
Pretty good place to start. And, of course, what is the menorah? It's a light.
It's light.
But it really is just a light.
Well, that's the promise to Abraham. I'm going to make you light, like light.
You're going to make you like light.
Well, you know, let me just say one thing. As I was looking through this today, it's so odd because you're getting up to a section where you're going to talk in great detail about light. And I was looking at the English translations of it, which, quite frankly, or they tell the same story, and you can't really miss it. The only way you can miss it is you have to really believe that Abraham, that Yahweh told Abraham that he was talking about your family would be in the millions. That's not what he said. It's the reverse. You're the child, and I'm going to turn, and you get to join me and be like I am, which is be like light, and traverse the universe. Yet the English translators said the opposite, and they still don't get it. And still don't get it. I just want to pull out my hair. I said,
yeah, I don't think any of us could get it if we didn't take the word seriously and work at translating them accurately. And it gets into a lot more than just rendering the word. That's what we started out with. Just, let's just try to render these words correctly. So that's a good start, right? And then we started to say, wait a minute, we were only picking up a small percentage of what the words actually meant. And then we learned that, well, there's stems on these words. And they establish a relationship that's really insightful. And then we learned that there's conjugations on these words. And that sometimes is more important than even the word itself. And then we learned that there are moods. And then we learned that, well, Hebrew is just like light. Time exists. No past, present, and future. And on it goes. And then we learned little nuances, like how many words in Hebrew have ama or me, like mikra.
Mm-hmm.
Before them, and you learn, well, what is the ma before the kara that makes it mikra? Why make it mikra? Why? Mishpat. You know, mishpat is ma and shafat. What is the ma doing there? And then you realize, well, ma in Hebrew is an interrogative. It's a question to think about the who, the what, the why, the where, the when of executing good judgment, of the invitations to be with God. And so, you know, just keep on growing along the way just by making a really big deal of the words.
Yeah. So there's not going to be a short form.
There isn't a short. Well, you know, I made a promise to this fellow. And I really like this fellow. This fellow, he is currently an agnostic. He's taking the book seriously, I've told him that, you know, and he's very bright, doesn't have a college education, but he's still very bright. And I said, you know, if you get through these books, you don't have to read all of them, but you get through enough of these books where you get it, and you choose because you like the God that you get to know. You think he's cool, fun, adventurous. You like him. And you want to accept the terms and conditions because you respect those and see the benefits of those. And after doing that and really spending the time of getting to know and getting the language used to communicate, if you think that there is a benefit of writing an invitation into the Yada Yada series that is really simple, because the closest thing I ever came to that was an introduction to God, and then now this little excerpt from it that is one of the chapters of it rewritten. If you think that that's what we ought to be doing, I'm not opposed to do it, because I hear a lot of people say that's what we need as a kara into the Torah, as an invitation into the teaching. But I said, you've got to get there, and then we'll write it together. So we'll see. You know, and I throw that challenge out to anyone who's listening who's part of the covenant. But, I think it's Molly, but I'm not positive. And if I've got the wrong person, I really apologize. Who has written the Torah for children, and has taken what she has learned by reading Yada Yada and an Introduction to God and Observations for Our Time. And she has taken that so that children, her children in particular, but all children have, can study and understand it. And, Kirk, the number of young children whose parents have become members of the covenant, who are Torah observant, whose children now know and love Yahweh's name, understand the purpose of the Moed Mikra, understand the covenant, and are celebrating those things with their parents, it's huge. It's really, really substantial. So there is a purpose of that, of simplifying it so that the children too can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the part of the approach.
Well, I just reviewed.
We can capitalize on that.
Yeah, I just reviewed Molly's thing. I haven't gotten a chance to get back to her. It's been kind of an odd, a difficult week. But yes, I'm pretty sure you're talking about Molly there, at least.
I think it's Molly, the school teacher, right?
Yeah, that's Molly.
Yeah, I think she's the one that wrote it. Jackie now is becoming one of the most wonderful contributors as an editor of these books. So it keeps me from looking like I'm a dunderhead, or at least a complete dunderhead. But yeah, so she's got that. And that's a wonderful contribution, and you know, maybe the answer to that question isn't me. Maybe I'm the wrong person to write that, just because it's not where I'm at. I'm at how much more can we see, not how much less can we see. You know, it's just maybe I just may be the wrong guy for that, and that's okay too. And maybe it's others working with Jackie to create it. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's the answer.
Maybe.
You know, we're a family. We're not. This isn't about individuals. It's about a family. And so we can all contribute. Anyway, Kirk, it's been wonderful. I'm sorry. I apologize for taking all of the lot tonight. But I really appreciate you with the things you had to say. I was intrigued by them, learned from them.
Well, every time, we sit here and look at it, it's always a pleasure.
It's fun, isn't it? Yeah, it's just fun. It's
pretty fun.
The best way to spend one's time is to celebrate the words of Yahweh and the relationship we have with Him and what we can learn from Him, because He's the ultimate teacher. And I'm convinced that eternity is all about continuing to learn from the Creator of the universe.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be hands-on learning. I mean, I really think we're going to have the opportunity to say, all right, you want to go create a galaxy, or a little more modest, a solar system, or a little more modest, a planet, or a little more modest, an ecosystem out there, and have at it. Make your own platypus. say, I'm going to tell you that, and if given that opportunity, there will be no chiggers and no mosquitoes in mine. I think they're really bad design.
Okay.
No chiggers, no mosquitoes.
I'm not real fond of flies either. So you can add that.
No, no. So we're nor poison oak or poison ivy.
I don't like fire coral
when I'm diving.
No barracuda.
Yeah, I've never had a problem with a barracuda, but they do look a little bit menacing. They do look menacing. I think the poor shark's gotten a bad rap. So. All right, my friend. My pleasure. Shabbat shalom to everyone. Good night.
Shabbat shalom to you. Good evening. Bye, y'all.